This episode is brought to you in collaboration with Soak It Up Cloths, turning practical, environmentally friendly Swedish sponge cloths into clever, fun gifts and souvenirs. Learn more at soakitupcloths.com. Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. Renee Powers here. On today's episode, we'll share with you our November Book of the Month, our second product reveal for our November boxes, a giveaway, and a brilliant interview with Cecily Wong about her book Diamond Head and the Craft of Writing. But first, will we see you this weekend? We'll be at the Women Mean Business Luncheon at the Minneapolis Convention Center on Friday and the Twin Cities Book Festival on Saturday. We'll have a table at both events. Feminist Book Club will be represented, and I would love to meet you. We've got links to both events in the show notes so you can get all of the details. And if you come to either one, make sure you seek us out and tell me you're a podcast listener. I would love to say hello. As promised, I am thrilled to announce our November Book of the Month, and I can't believe we're already to that point where we're talking about our November Book of the Month. Anyways, we will be reading the brand new memoir, Know My Name by Chanel Miller. Here's a little bit about the book in case you're not familiar with it yet. She was known to the world as Emily Doe when she stunned millions with a letter. Brock Turner had been sentenced to just 6 months in county jail after he was found sexually assaulting her on Stanford's campus. Her victim impact statement was posted on BuzzFeed, where it went instantly viral, viewed by 11 million people within 4 days. It was translated globally and read on the floor of Congress. It inspired changes in California law and the recall of the judge in the case. Thousands wrote to say that she had given them the courage to share their own experiences of assault for the first time. Now she reclaims her identity to tell her story of trauma, transcendence, and the power of words. It was the perfect case in many ways. There were eyewitnesses, Turner ran away, physical evidence was immediately secured, but her struggles with isolation and shame during the aftermath and the trial reveal the oppression that victims face in even best case scenarios. Her story illuminates a culture biased to protect perpetrators, indicts a criminal justice system designed to fail the most vulnerable, and ultimately shines with the courage required to move through suffering and live a full and beautiful life. Know My Name will forever transform the way we think about sexual assault, challenging our beliefs about what is acceptable, and speaking truth to the tumultuous reality of healing. It also introduces readers to an extraordinary writer, one whose words have already changed our world. Entwining pain, resilience, and humor, this memoir will stand as a modern classic. So if you'd like to read along with us next month, be sure to check out all of our membership options in our shop, which is, as always, feministbookclub.com/shop, and definitely use the promo code podcast. That's our little way of saying thank you for listening. Now, last week, I let you know that the first woman-owned product that we'll be featuring in our November boxes is Vegan Baking Mix from Vixt Baking Company. As always, our books are accompanied by 2 to 4 products from woman-owned businesses, so I'm so excited to share that we're also partnering with Soak It Up Cloths for this box, too. We're committed to being as eco-friendly as possible behind the scenes at Feminist Book Club headquarters, and that goes for our packaging is simple, and we don't have a whole lot of filler product, and we try to do this company in the most green way possible, environmentally friendly. And one way we also do that is to limit our use of paper towels. Soak It Up Cloths are perfect for this. And honestly, I know I'm in my 30s when I start getting excited about cleaning supplies, but hear me out. Soak It Up Cloths are compostable, dishwasher safe, and quick drying. Plus, one single cloth can replace 15 rolls of paper towels. And they also come in super cute designs. I'm a sucker for cleaning supplies that are also cute. So make sure you reserve your November box today so you also can try out the Soak It Up Cloths and see for yourself. Today's interview is with the author of Diamond Head. Her name is Cecily Wong. We are giving away a copy of this beautiful book, so be sure to click through the show notes for how to enter, or also find that link in our Instagram bio. We're Feminist Book Club Box over on Instagram. And just a note, while you're listening, there are some sirens in the background audio of this interview. So no, you're probably not being pulled over if you're listening to this in the car. That's all on us. That's not on you. Sorry about that. Those were hard to edit out. All right. Without further ado, here we go. Hi, everyone. Today, I'm sitting down with Cecily Wong. Cecily is the author of the novel Diamond Head, which is a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writer selection and a recipient of the Elle Magazine Reader's Prize and voted a best debut of the Brooklyn Book Festival. Her work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the LA Review of Books, Self Magazine, Bustle, and elsewhere. And she is a graduate of Barnard College and lives in Brooklyn, where she's a writer at Atlas Obscura. Welcome, Cecily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Am I correct in my thought that Barnard is a women's college?
It is.
Oh, I'm a women's college alum too. I went to St. Mary's at Notre Dame.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So also attached to a school with boys, but for women.
Exactly. Best of both worlds.
Exactly. That's what I wanted too.
So the first question I ask everyone is, what is your definition of feminism?
So feminism to me, I guess, is the spectrum of understanding that there are these cultural and historical and institutional inequalities and just how boys and girls are raised, and then how men and women are expected to behave and how they're expected to achieve and how that empowers or limits us. And in the case of most women, you know, it limits us. And for me, feminism is that work that needs to be done in order to correct, you know, this very real imbalance in society, and also the work to getting society to believe that, you know, not just the women, but the men. And, you know, it's great. And I'm happy that I know a lot of men my age now who are starting to come to terms with this and their advantage and their privilege just by virtue of being men and all the blind spots that that's created and perhaps how they see the world. Feminism to me is about recognizing that power imbalance and that it's entirely arbitrary and founded in, you know, nothing but these cultural and historical norms, and then wanting to do something about it.
Yeah, I think that there's something about recognizing that we don't know what we don't know. And that's part of the work of undoing privilege. And I like what you say about men. Like, I'm grateful for my, you know, male and masculine friends who tend to see those blind spots better than others.
Absolutely. Or at least willing to recognize it.
Exactly. And so I think that we've made a lot of progress in terms of feminism, but there's still a lot more to go.
For sure. And I think that we're kind of in this generation where it's more about people who are willing to have that conversation, mm-hmm. and not be scared off by it or not be made, you know, too uncomfortable so that it can't happen.
Yeah. And are you a millennial?
Yes.
Yeah, same.
I sure am.
And I think it's starting to, I'm just really excited about the generation behind us, honestly. I think that Gen Z is going to actually change the world.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's kind of looking that way. I think that we are all aligning on certain things, and that power is going to look different as we ascend.
For sure. So let's talk a little bit about your writing. So I told you before we started recording, I think I read Diamond Head in two sittings. It is just so immersive and readable. And I read it, and here's the interesting thing. I read it right after I read Pachinko by Min-Jin Lee.
A beautiful, beautiful book.
And then If You Leave Me by Crystal Hannah Kim.
Yes.
Whose episode, she's been on the podcast. I'll link that in the show notes. These three books that I read consecutively were just so beautiful and so similar in a lot of ways, in that they're sweeping family sagas of several generations with Asian and Asian American characters. And it was just, yeah, it was really beautiful. So tell me.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Definitely recommend that trio of books. So tell me a little bit about Diamond Head for our listeners that haven't read it yet.
Sure. So Diamond Head, as you said, it's a historical family saga. It follows the Leongs, and they are a Chinese shipping family that immigrates from China to Hawaii after the Boxer Rebellion at the end of the 20th century. And it essentially follows just the many, many mistakes they make along the way. many of which are only revealed once they get to Hawaii. And the story, it follows three generations, and it's held together kind of by this this Chinese parable called the Red String of Fate. And that parable essentially says that every person in the world is connected to their fated match, or their, you know, their perfect person, by a red string that's tied around both of their ankles, and that they will eventually find each other if they don't knot up their string too much with bad choices in love. So like affairs or prostitutes, or, you know, in the case of the people living in the 20th century, concubines. And that's kind of where it goes wrong with the Liangs. And they watch as these knots are inherited, and as they kind of, you know, are passed down to the generations, and what it means to be connected to the people who came before you in these kinds of choices, good or bad.
Yeah, there's almost a sense of intergenerational inheritance of the Red String parable too, as by which I mean younger generations inherit some of the mistakes that their parents make with their red string.
Absolutely. That was one of the biggest things I was drawn to with the red string, is that I think it just mirrors so well how that works generationally, and how you do inherit things from your parents and from their parents that both help you and hinder you, and that, you know, you get these knots, but you also get your own string. And so you get to guide your fate as much as it's given to you.
Is your heritage Chinese?
Yes.
So did you grow up hearing about the red string parable then?
No, I didn't. I actually went looking for this curse. I knew I wanted a curse. I had just finished reading Junot Diaz's The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, and I just thought that his curse worked so well. And I was trying to write this novel, and I thought, you know, I need a curse. And so I went looking for it, and I read a lot of curses and a lot of parables. And this one just, you know, a lot of curses and parables are either, you know, they're really neat, and it's, you know, you do this and this happens, or they're really punitive, and this one kind of struck that balance for me, which is between, you know, what you have the ability to do and what you don't have the ability to do.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I interrupted you when I asked you about your heritage. Oh. Did you want to expand on that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I am told that I am full Chinese, but we have been in Hawaii as a family for like 130 years now. And so I'm definitely culturally very attached to Hawaii, and pretty far away from being Chinese, except for the fact that I am. And so it's this kind of strange relationship with a place I've never been, which is China, and a place where all my family lives that I'm not connected to by blood, which is Hawaii.
Yeah. At the very beginning, you have an author's note that talks about your connection to Hawaii and your family's connection, and how some of the places and things are made up, or you take some, you know, artistic liberties with it, but it is so, it is kind of in homage to your family and how they grew up. Can you talk a little more about your connection to the story and the setting?
Yeah, absolutely. Hawaii and my family is what made me want to write this book. I was born there, but I moved to Oregon when I was 7. It was crazy for me because I went from being on an Asian majority island to being one of the few Asian people pretty much anywhere, like anywhere I went. And I came of age that way. And so my race was on display just constantly. It was something that was always on my mind. And so Diamondhead was kind of a way to figure out where I'd come from and who I was, and to get to know my family a little more, because it was just my mom and my dad and my brother and my sister in Oregon. And then I had this massive family on Oahu. Whenever I go, we have these like 150 person family parties where, you know, I have to relearn everyone's name, and we're drawing family trees on napkins, and we're trying to figure out, you know, how everyone's related. And we don't always figure it out, but it's a small island and a big family. And so Diamondhead kind of gave me this excuse to go back on my own and start asking questions. And I think I wasn't even sure. I started in undergrad and I wasn't even sure I was writing a novel at the time. I just knew that this is what I was drawn to on the page. And so I got to do that. And I got to go and sit around a table with my family and ask them questions about their lives and get to know the island a little more. And then I got to keep doing it, you know, throughout this process. After it got bought, I got to go back and, you know, do more research, just smell the flowers and describe them and figure out which side of the road the beach is on and do that kind of, you know, awesome recon. And then when it came out, I got to go back and kind of celebrate with them. And so it's been great for me that it gave me, I had to learn a lot of stuff about something that's a part of me, but that that was not.
I love that you said you had to draw family trees, because I'm sitting here with a drawn family tree of your characters.
No way.
Absolutely. Because I read this a couple months ago and I thought, okay, there are some characters in here that I remember their names. I don't remember how they're related. I need to sit down and draw a diagram for this conversation.
That's so funny. Actually, when I was working on early drafts of this book and I was having some friends read it, I said, if you can draw a family tree at the end, then it's clear enough. But yes. If you can't, then... Yeah. And so that was an exercise after reading. I was like, try and draw a family tree.
It was clear. And to our listeners, it's not that there are a lot of characters. It's just that they have very distinct stories and you jump back and forth in time quite a bit too.
Exactly.
So for my own purposes, yeah. I like to have character maps.
Me too.
One of the storylines is a young woman in poverty who is a huge family. I think she has 8 or 10 siblings.
Yeah.
And gets married off to I'm assuming the wealthiest family on the island.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we see this disparity in class a lot. I just think that this lens was so interesting. Can you talk about class issues in the book and why it was important to you to write this into the story?
I feel like when it comes to women, so I come from a family where in my direct line, I'm the first woman who went to college. And the women in my family, as you trace it back, you know, they cleaned houses and they washed dishes and they cooked for a living and they didn't go to college and they were kind of minding the men of our family. And that is just what you were supposed to do and what life looked like for a woman. And I think that for a long time, the escape hatch was marriage. And that was pretty much it. You know, you weren't, there wasn't a lot on the table. And so this character's name is Amy, and she is the daughter of a photographer. And he's a struggling photographer. He's not making any money, and his family's living in poverty. And then Pearl Harbor is bombed, and war breaks out, and all of these soldiers come in, and they need photographs right away. And so he starts meeting all of these people, and one of the people he meets is the Leongs, which is this rich family on Oahu. And they have an introverted son who is kind of past marrying age, and he needs a wife. And so they start courting Amy, who is beautiful. And that's kind of the currency of a woman a lot of times, especially historically. I wanted to kind of map what that power dynamic looks like and how it's common, but it's also nuanced and it's complex about who actually does hold the power, because you have this man who is born into money and yet he's an introverted person who doesn't understand how to socialize and can't get a wife of his own. And so he's, you know, is the power in his favor that someone needs to find him a wife who doesn't love him, or is the power with Amy because she's able to do something that changes her family's life? You know, yeah. I mean, I don't even think I really have the answer, but
yeah. Yeah. No, I like what you're saying about marriage as really the only ticket out of poverty. And I think it's often still the case. What I think is beautiful is we have this sweeping family saga, but it's all told from the perspective of the woman in different generations. Was that important to you to forefront women's voices?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I assume so, but...
yeah. No, I mean, exactly. As you said, the women are the only one who speak. And while their lives are determined largely by the actions of the men, they are the only ones, you know, it gets filtered through their thoughts and their experiences and all of that. And I'm not even sure I did it intentionally. I think I'm just drawn to, I don't really read a lot of books about men. And this is something that I've realized while I'm reading articles about how people are only reading men, or they're only reading stories about men. That's just not my experience. Like, I'm only drawn to women's narratives and largely women writers. And so it was just kind of intuitive that that's where you start. And then I just kept going backwards in time, and that's where my focus was drawn to.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I too only read women's stories. With a podcast like this, you would kind of have to, but you mentioned briefly that you started writing this in undergrad. Tell me about the writing process. How long did it take you, and what was that like?
Yeah, sure. Yes, I started this in undergrad. It was kind of by accident. I've always liked to write. I was an Italian major, which my parents loved.
Oh, parlo italiano.
Parlo italiano. Sì, sì. L'hai studiato.
Ah, oh, anch'io.
Brava.
That's incredible. Okay, so you studied Italian.
Yeah, I took a gap year. I went to Italy, and in between high school and college, and then I came back and I was just like obsessed. And so I decided this was a good major for me. So I'm doing that. I decide that I would love to get into writing, and Barnard has this awesome writing program, but it's selective and competitive. And anyway, I didn't get in. So I went across the street to Columbia, where there's no application process, and I took a class there. And actually, I got into that class because David Plant, who was the person teaching it, was also an avid Italian speaker. And so we just sat in his office for like an hour, we shot the shit, and at the end he had a full class, and he was like, okay, you can come in. So that was my first writing class, and with what I learned in that class, I got into the Barnard class. And then I just took this class with Mary Gordon until I graduated. I just took it over and over again, and I kept probing the story. At the time, it was my mother's story, and it was her growing up in the 60s, or being a child in the 60s, and kind of watching the turmoil that was happening in her house. And that's what I graduated with, about 50 pages of that. And Mary Gordon, who was my professor, she kind of said, you know, if you can turn this into a novel, I think you should try. And it really hadn't occurred to me that it would be a novel. And so I just got really stubborn about it. And I worked all sorts of weird jobs, and I started working on this novel. But what happened is that I showed it to my mom in early pages, and she was like, "No way, man, it's not time to like air out these stories. You know, like you said, you're writing fiction." And so that stuck with me. And, you know, I'm new to writing, and I'm trying to figure out how to write a book and write a book that I'm proud of, and that my family will be proud of, which I think, you know, also has roots in gender and race and family dynamics. But anyway, so I scrapped it, and I started going backwards and trying to figure out, you know, what stories I could tell that would be mine, and that would still center around this place that I was trying to get to know, and this culture that I didn't really understand, but that would be stories that came from my own imagination. And so what started as writing down things that I knew had happened to my mom, it became an exercise in actually writing fiction. Mm. And and so I traced it back further and further, and found the stories that my mom could not tell me, and that my grandparents could not tell me, and or the stories they were fine with. and it went from there.
How long did it take you from graduation, let's say?
So I graduated in 2010, and the book came out in 2015.
Yeah.
So it was about three or four years to write.
Yeah. Do you write full time now?
I do, but not just fiction. I'm also writing a nonfiction book for Alice Obscura. It is called Gastro Obscura, and it is a wacky encyclopedia of food from around the world. It's super fun. It's like a great kind of foil to my fiction writing, which is like deeply emotional and fraught. And then writing about, you know, this like crazy mango that tastes like vomit is just like, you know, left brain, right brain.
What is that called? Like Durden or something? Tyler Durden.
Durian is the most one that's like not allowed in hotels and like in elevators and stuff. Like you'll see signs in Asia that's like, no shoes, no shirt, no durian. Like it just like it all goes like together. But yeah, so I do write full time. But it's not just fiction, which saves me a lot of the time mentally.
Yeah. So I'm always curious about people's writing practices, especially for those of you that do write full time, even though it might be several different projects. Are you the type to get up in the morning, put on your pants, pour your cup of coffee, and sit right down at your computer and start writing? Or is there something ritualistic that you have to do to get into that headspace? So, like, just tell me about that process.
Yeah. So I'm kind of a weirdo in that I do get up and not always put on pants, but I do sit right down.
I approve.
Start writing. Yeah. I mean, honestly, there are rarely pants, but I'm usually sitting down and getting to it. I think which is why I can do this full time, because I kind of stress myself out thinking about, you know, how to do it and how to make it happen. And so it does just have to get done. But no, I have to alternate. I have to kind of track the progress of my brain and its freshness. And so I will jump around between projects and what needs to get done. So like, I know that I will need, you know, fresh morning brain for writing a hard scene or, you know, usually writing new material. And then with more like fluid, I guess I would call it creative, but also editing, where you're following an emotion, or you're just, you know, you're sitting there and you're thinking, because, you know, lots of times that's just what writing looks like, is you just kind of like sitting there. It takes a different kind of brain. So I feel like I'm always kind of watching out for where I am mentally and pairing it against what needs to be done and praying. That's the right mashup.
I love that. Do you ever just get tapped out where, I mean, what does it look like when you're just over it? You just can't write. Do you take time to recoup, or do you power through?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, you have to take time to recoup. I mean, it's not always possible because of deadlines, but for example, last week I turned in the final chapter for this book for Alice Obscura that I'm writing. And then I went on a long run and I cried. And it was like kind of therapeutic. And just like that's, and then I emailed my editor. I was like, okay, like I just cried on the treadmill. So I think we're done. And, you know, it just, it comes out in weird ways because you are, you know, delivering so much from the inner part of you, you know, fiction or nonfiction. And so when it comes to just like being overwhelmed, you know, there's like, obviously, like, you know, physical things that come out. When it comes to feeling dry on the page with fiction, it's a different exercise for me. And I know that I need to read. There's nothing for me that gets me more like revved up to write fiction than to read amazing fiction. I mean, that's how I got into this to begin with, is that there is, I mean, it's great. I mean, after, you know, 10 years of doing this, fiction is still completely pleasure for me. I don't think of it of, you know, as work in any way. I hope I can keep it this way for as long as possible. But yeah, so I'll take, you know, a day or two off and I'll just inhale something, and by the end, you know, your mind is doing this kind of subconscious work of seeing narrative arcs and reading good dialogue that's been polished, you know, 70 times, and reading a like a banger of an ending, or just things that are just like, okay, it makes you want to do it. And so whenever I'm dry, I read. And even when I don't like the book, it helps.
Yes.
You know, it's just,
and it also makes you appreciate good fiction.
Absolutely.
You read a dud.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you learn, you read a sentence, you're like, why does that suck? And then you have to figure it out. It's the same exercise as why is this good?
Yeah. Do you remember what you were reading? I mean, I'll ask you for a book recommendation later, but do you remember what you were reading as you wrote Diamond Head?
You know, so much because it took so long. But this book was definitely inspired by the only book or the only books that I read while I was growing up, which were Asian family sagas, largely Amy Tan's books. And so, you know, I don't come from a big reading family, and we got all of our books at Costco, and I read a lot of Amy Tan because that's what my mom would read. And so that's what started it. And then I started reading. So I will say that Juno Diaz's Oscar Wow is what I read that was like, okay, you should write a family saga. Family saga is what you want to write. But those are just kind of the books that I was drawn to as a reader. And so I feel like that's the book that you write. I love Jhumpa Lahiri. She was super, super formative in just kind of the how to amplify the domestic drama and how to show that really like fierce but intimate interior life and how to, you know, put someone in a house and you know exactly where everything is. And so those were my building block books. And yeah.
You just put words to what I have been trying. I've been trying to come up with this phrase that you just articulated so well to describe writing. It is that fierce and intimate interior life. I feel that so deeply with your book and your writing. And so thank you for saying that because you achieved it.
Thank you for saying that.
It's beautiful. So we are coming to the end. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you would like to discuss? I know you're working on a project now that you say is kind of hard to articulate at the moment, but in the similar vein, a little more contemporary, do you want to talk about that? Do you want to talk about something else? Or shall we just wrap up?
No, I mean, this was really lovely. Thank you so much. It's really nice to talk about craft and about writing and about reading. It's always a joy to have a dedicated half hour to do that.
Yes. I'm so lucky I get to do it at least once a week.
It's so great. I mean, how wonderful that this can exist in this world. But I'm getting to the end of a new project. It is exciting and terrifying, and I'm so sick of it at this point.
That's always a sign.
You know, I think that's when you know that you're getting close is when you're actually ready to release it. Honestly, when I talk about Diamond Head, I think it still sounds a little like, why don't you have a pitch yet? So I definitely don't have one quite with this one, but I said to you before that it was really important to me that I wrote a contemporary novel this time. I just had this feeling that if I wrote another historical Asian novel, I would not be able to write anything else ever again for the rest of my career. So I wanted to do something very, very different. But it still deals with things that I'm most preoccupied with, which is families and siblings and emotional inheritance. And so, yeah, fingers crossed.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. Hear more about it. I can't wait to read it. And you'll have to come back on when that's out so we can talk about it some more.
Absolutely.
And we are giving away a copy of Diamond Head. So if you are interested in picking this up, obviously go find it at your nearest indie bookseller, but you can also enter to win in the show notes. You'll click a link in there and we'll throw in some Feminist Book Club goodies as well. Cecily, this has been delightful. We always wrap up with the same two questions. The first one is, if you have a book to recommend that's not your own, what would you recommend?
I loved this book called The Animators by Kayla Ray Whitaker. And it's a debut. It's about two female animators. And they make cartoons. And it is a hilarious and smart female friendship novel. And I've been recommending it to everyone.
I have to check this out. I haven't heard of it. Is it relatively new?
I think it came out maybe last year.
Okay.
But yeah, no, it's fantastic.
All right. We'll link that in the show notes as well. Sounds fantastic. And then our last question is, if we want to connect with you further, find you online, where's the best way to do that?
I am kind of a hermit when it comes to being online, but I do have a Twitter and it is my name, Cecily Ann Wong. I'm there sometimes.
All right. Well, we will keep our Twitter and Instagram followers aware of anything new coming from you. Don't worry.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate
that. Even if you're not there, we will help out, amplify that. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. Oh, 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 oh. A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.